Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Thursday, December 3. I'm your reader, Kathleen Jesperson. Brief look at the weather for today and the next few days coming up. Mostly sunny today in Cedar Rapids with a high of 39 and a low of 21. Again tomorrow, mostly sunny with a high of 42 and a low of 20. Moving into Saturday, looks the same, high of 41 and a low of 19. We are in the waning gibbous moon phase. Sunset tonight is at 4:36 and sunrise tomorrow at 7:18, giving us 9 hours and 19 minutes of daylight. In the weather story, a quiet and mild December started off early in eastern Iowa with multiple rounds of snow at the end of October. As we've gotten into our more typical snow season, though, the snow's been hard to come by, and it looks as though that will continue for a while. Throughout the extended forecast, we still have little to no precipitation in the forecast. In addition, mild December weather is expected over the next few weeks. As we approach the weekend, we'll see highs reach back into the 40s with plenty of sunshine, above average for early December. By next week, some may even see highs into the mid-40s. Long-range outlooks keep us in the above-average bubble through at least mid-December, with continued limited precipitation. Moving to the front page of today's Gazette, driver's route extends beyond the school bus. This story is by Grace King. With the Central City Community School District switching to remote virtual instruction for now as it monitors the spread of the coronavirus, school bus driver Vaughn McClelland is taking on duties beyond being behind the wheel. McClelland, age 73, of Coggin, is making and delivering lunches to students this week as the district began virtual learning after the Thanksgiving break to monitor an expected increase in local COVID-19 cases. A bus driver for 10 years, McClelland is volunteering this year to take on the extra responsibilities of cook, paraeducator, and lunchroom monitor as the district copes with staffing shortages in the pandemic. "You couldn't ask for a better job," he said. "I'm like a grandfather to a lot of these kids. I watch them grow up." Despite COVID-19, McClelland didn't hesitate to return as a bus driver this year. His doctor told him that, "I'm probably the healthiest 73-year-old around," he said. "I really didn't give it much thought." Students on his bus from preschool through high school wear masks, and he said school has done a great job of taking precautions. The district's return to learn plan had middle and high school students in small cohorts who stay in their homeroom all day instead of switching between classes. Teachers provided instruction virtually. High school principal Jason McLaughlin said that while the district still struggles with shortages of substitute teachers, bus drivers, and cooks, people like McClelland make all the difference in the world. "It shows we're here for each other, people doing jobs that aren't theirs, and being willing to create a sense of camaraderie," McLaughlin said. "I see this as a huge opportunity to prove we care about each other." This week, the district decided against any in-person classes and switched to all online learning after alerting the Iowa Department of Education Superintendent Tim Cronin said, "If we're going to see an uptick in cases, we didn't want to be in school for that," he said. Wednesday evening, the district informed parents the virtual instruction would continue next week as well to December 11. Elementary students who have only one teacher this week are experiencing virtual learning for the first time. Cronin said teachers have worked with students to know how to log on to the classroom and complete assignments online. The district's absence rate for students sick or out on quarantine has fluctuated between 12% and 16% throughout the semester. Just considering students out sick, the absence rate has been 4% to 6%. Like most every district in the area, Central City has struggled with staff absences. "We've had some staff who have gone above and beyond to help us stay open," Cronin said. "It's humbling to work with people who are super dedicated, who will help in food service or as a para, even though it's not their job." The district has had to close 2 classrooms for a few days each if it was unable to find a substitute, Cronin said. During that time, students in those classes remain home in virtual learning. If it's shut down, A classroom versus the district, that's what we're going to do, he said. When students are in school in person, the homeroom model for middle and high school students is different for students and teachers used to switching classes every hour. To keep spirits up, Principal McLaughlin introduced Fun Fridays. Every Friday, homerooms compete against each other in challenges or activities. One Friday, they mimicked the reality TV show Chopped, where three mystery ingredients must be included in a recipe. Judges were chosen to sample the students' no-bake recipes, and the results were live-streamed to each classroom. The district also implemented a D and F day for 2 days at the end of October, where students struggling in classes were required to attend school and get focused help. Students with C's and above got to take 2 days off. McLaughlin hopes this is something the district can continue after the coronavirus pandemic is over. That's something you would never do during a regular year, but in the world of virtual learning, we identified it as a problem and offered flexibility and got good results, Cronin said. Moving inside to the Iowa Today page, a former Cedar Rapids nurse pleads not guilty to stealing fentanyl from a surgery center. This story is by Trish Mahaffey. A former Cedar Rapids nurse pleaded not guilty Wednesday in federal court to stealing fentanyl from the clinic where she worked and covering up her theft by refilling the vials with another substance. Sabrina Thalblum, 52, of Cedar Rapids, was indicted in U.S. District Court on one count each of tampering and attempting to tamper with a consumer product, vials of fentanyl, and acquiring and attempting to acquire a controlled substance by misrepresentation, fraud, deception, and subterfuge. U.S. Magistrate Judge Mark Roberts released Thalblum without bond, pending trial set for February 1. Thalblum worked at a Unity Point Health St. Luke's Outpatient Surgery Center in Cedar Rapids from October 2017 to August 2019, according to the indictment. She was issued a nursing license by the Iowa Board of Nursing in 2013. The indictment states Thalblum gained access to fentanyl at the surgery center from August 2018 through August 2019. She is accused of diverting the fentanyl for her own use. To cover up her theft, she obtained fine-gauge needles for a syringe to carefully puncture the vials of fentanyl and withdraw what she wanted of the opioid that is similar to morphine, the indictment states. Thalblum refilled the vials with another clear substance to make them appear full, according to the indictment. She also re-glued the caps on the vials so they would appear new and unopened, and the labels remained on the vials. A statement of charges and settlement agreement filed in June with the Iowa Board of Nursing shows Thalblum admitted to tampering and diverting fentanyl from the surgery center and also admitted to having a substance abuse problem. Her license at that time was indefinitely suspended until August 24. She would be placed on probation for a year and have to show sobriety for 12 months. There were numerous other requirements during her probation period, according to the document. The indictment shows that if Thalblum is convicted, she must forfeit her nursing license and any property or proceeds she received as a result of the theft if she sold the drugs. If convicted, she faces up to 10 years on the tampering charge and 4 years on the other charge. Also on the Iowa Today page, this story by Diana Nolan. Americans in Paris, wood and cone paint vivid visage of City of Lights. Before they painted dour faces, rolling hills, clouds, and doors, Grant Wood and Marvin Cohn were innocents abroad, traveling in Paris in 1920 to create art in the open air around them. To celebrate the centennial of that trip, their Impressionist impressions are on view through October 10 in 2 second-floor galleries at the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art. Going to Paris was the method of finishing your art education in early 20th century, said Kate Cuno, the museum's associate curator. You weren't really an artist if you hadn't gone to Europe and been inspired by the old masters, because Europe was still center of the art world in 1920. It was kind of an artistic finishing school, especially for those who would have been perceived as bumpkin Midwesterners. That was very important, to go to Europe to see the great works before you yourself were an artist. That was especially important to them since Impressionism had come out of France 50 years ago. They're going to the birthplace of the style that they've been painting in. They took a train from Chicago to Montreal, then set sail across the Atlantic to spend the summer immersing themselves most days in the Luxembourg Gardens, an oasis in Paris's famed Left Bank. Artists and writers and musicians flourished there. Kohn's diary lends delightful insight into their time and travels, Kuno noted. He wrote of the very pretty ladies they wined and dined in Chicago, and in Paris the two men photographed each other drinking a beer. And it's on the trip home when Kohn would meet his wife, Winifred. It's fun to think about those two guys in their 20s during a summer in Paris together, Kuno said, adding that Kohn devoted an entire paragraph in his diary to the superiority of European bread and butter, and how he could make a whole meal out of bread. They traveled on a shoestring budget, staying for free in monks' quarters in Montreal, then in hostels and rented rooms abroad, eating cheaply and cramming their suitcases full of 15-inch by 13-inch boards on which to paint. This was by no means an extravagant trip, Kuno said, but it is rich in artistry. They would sometimes paint together, other times work separately, painting the architecture and environments that caught their eye. Kohn incorporated more people in his paintings, whereas Wood might occasionally include one or two blurred figures. They also sought out lesser-known sites, giving viewers another glimpse of Paris apart from landmarks such as the Eiffel Tower. They're drawn to out-of-the-way sites and more intimate scenes, she said. There are a couple of churches, but they're not major. It's a lot of village square kind of works. It's really interesting, and they're lovely pieces. The exhibition features about 30 pieces, mostly oil paintings, but also some sketch drawings and photographs the artists took of each other. It holds surprises for viewers familiar with the artist's later style, which involved more bird's-eye view of landscapes and harder images. The style is vastly different from the mature styles of both of these artists. It's very quick, very brushy, very expressive. The paint is thicker. Marvin Kohn goes on to have a very spare use of paint. This is 1920. Grant's style really turns the corner in 1928 when he goes to Munich to work with the Emil Frey Stained Glass Company there, the result of which is the 20 by 24 foot stained glass window gracing the Second Avenue entrance to the Veterans Memorial Building in downtown Cedar Rapids. Kuno called this centennial exhibition the front runner to subsequent Wood exhibitions planned for 2021. Seriously Funny American Gothic Parodies will be on view from January 16th to May 2, and Grant Wood Revealed, Rarely Seen Works by an American Master, is slated for February 13 to May 16. In addition, the museum has separate first-floor galleries devoted to works by Wood and Kohn. The first thing I heard when I started my job here in 2015 was that we need more Grant Wood, Kuno said. I've certainly never heard anything to the contrary. I've never heard too much Grant Wood. And at a glance, the exhibition Americans in Paris, Grant Wood and Marvin Kohn's 1920 trip to Paris, is on view through October 10, 2021 at the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art. Hours are noon to 4, Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday, noon to 8 on Thursday, and 10 to 4 on Saturday. Admission is $8 for adults, $7 for college students and 62 and older, $4 for ages 6 to 18, and free for 5 and under. Face masks are required. Also on the Iowa Today page, No Sleigh for Santa, this story by Gage Miskimen. Marion's annual Christmas in the Park event will adapt this holiday season to celebrate safely during the pandemic. This year's event, with the theme of Marion Home for the Holidays, kicks off on Friday. Traditionally, the event is held in City Square Park with horse-drawn carriage rides, hot chocolate, and a chance to visit Santa Claus. But this year, Santa and Mrs. Claus will be visiting Marion neighborhoods aboard a fire truck. Tammy Schlamp, Director of Member Services for the Marion Chamber of Commerce, said the fire truck and Santa will cruise city neighborhoods Friday evening. We're doing a neighborhood wave similar to what we saw teachers do in the spring, Schlamp said. The Clauses tour will begin at 5:30, 6:15, and 7 p.m. Schlamp said the idea came from volunteers who helped plan all the chamber's events. It's taken a lot of people thinking outside the box and outside the park, where we hold a lot of our events typically, she said. This event has been going on for years, and multiple generations have participated together, seeing the peace tree and visiting Santa. She said derecho damage to City Square Park trees played a factor, too. The 5:30 tour will end with Santa stopping at the park for the annual lighting of the peace tree. Because of COVID-19 restrictions on the size of outdoor gatherings, the lighting will be live-streamed on the Marion Chamber's Facebook page. During Santa's neighborhood routes, a truck will follow to collect new hats, gloves, and blankets with tags attached for the Keep Your Neighbors Warm initiative. Donated items will be distributed to local families in need. These will be given to the Marion Holiday Giving Project, which is a project the Marion Independent School District puts together, Schlamp said. The chamber also is bringing back the Letters to Santa program. Residents can drop off letters at Santa's house starting Friday. The house will be in the former bus stop area at 7th Avenue and 11th Street. If letters have a return address and are in the box by December 18, Santa will send a letter in return. We think that is kind of a lost part to Christmas, Schlamp said. You can get all these digital greetings now, and we just thought it would be fun to bring back the traditional letter writing of a letter. Chamber President Jill Ackerman said the organization also is excited to partner with the city for the Light the Night Holiday Lights Tour, encouraging residents and businesses to decorate their homes and buildings with lights. Interested individuals can submit their home to be included on the tour by emailing tireland@cityofmarion.org. We've included some prize money to get people to do it, and we're hoping to see some great displays, Ackerman said. Additionally, the Marion City Council matched the Chamber's Leadership in Action Program funds for this year's City Holiday displays, which will include new lights in Uptown Marion and on some of the city's roundabouts. Uptown Marion also will be holding local shopping events. In the Uptown Shop Local giveaway, which runs through December 21, participating businesses will have QR codes that, when scanned, will enter the shopper for a chance to win $50 in Uptown dollars. Individuals can vote for their favorite display using the QR code. Voting will run through the month of December. We know our plan was never to do nothing, Ackerman said of this year's events. We always knew we were going to provide some fun activity for our community. Being creative and finding unique ways to celebrate is what our focus was and has been the whole year. And in another Iowa Today story, Iowa school districts spend $43 million less during the pandemic. Iowa school districts spent less than they had been budgeted when the coronavirus closed Iowa schools this spring. That amounts to $89 less per student in the 2019-2020 budget year, which ended June 30. Overall, the state school districts reported spending $69 million less than budgeted because of the pandemic. But the districts reported having to spend almost $26 million on non-budgeted items related. That meant a net reduction in expenditures of $43 million, according to the nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency. Individual districts varied, including some that saw no reduction in expenditures, according to the fiscal update issued Tuesday. Also, more than 95% of the school districts responding to an optional question reported they expected to incur additional non-budgeted costs this fiscal year, because of the ongoing pandemic. The State Department of Education was required to prepare the report for the Iowa legislature by November 15. Moving to the Insight page, the Gazette's own editorial today, "If Feds Fail, State Must Act." Governor Kim Reynolds this week called on Congress to pass a new coronavirus relief package. Struggling families and small businesses need the support, Reynolds said at her Tuesday news conference. Reynolds is right. Congress ought to act quickly. Members have bickered for months about the size and specifications of another pandemic aid bill. With their inaction, they risk letting this public health emergency spin further out of control. The national eviction moratorium and extra unemployment assistance, both implemented by Congress early in the pandemic, are set to expire at the end of the year. On top of that, lawmakers need to pass a government spending bill by December 11 in order to avert a government shutdown. Senate Republicans and House Democrats both are wrong to impose preconditions and non-starters on their negotiations. A wise compromise would include generous unemployment and small business relief, but leave out two of the biggest sticking points: liability protection for businesses, which Democrats oppose, and cash relief to state and local governments, which Republicans oppose. Even a skinny bill like the $900 billion blueprint floated by a bipartisan Senate group this week would provide critical relief and help American families make it through to the new year. If our divided Congress and the lame duck president fail to act, Iowa lawmakers must fill the void. Asked at a recent news conference whether she might call for a special legislative session to pass an aid package at the state level, Reynolds said the state doesn't have enough resources. That was a perplexing answer, since state officials regularly tout the fact that the cash reserves are full at more than $700 million. Reynolds' refrain throughout the pandemic has been lives and livelihoods, meaning she aims to protect both public health and the economy. During a deadly infectious disease pandemic, government assistance is part of the livelihood equation. Without government action, more businesses will falter. State and federal leaders need to step up and offer some stability to workers and employers whose livelihoods are threatened by the coronavirus pandemic. While we hold out hope that Congress will do the right thing, it would be naive to count on it. Reynolds and the legislature should stand ready to fill in where the federal government stops short. What's a rainy day fund for, if not this? And again, that is the editorial from the Gazette. Two community letters today show the price we're paying for COVID-19 in Iowa. This by Mark Stark of Cedar Rapids. I would like to see the Gazette use one day's paper to highlight the Iowans who have lost, we have lost, to COVID-19. Use the entire edition to show pictures, ages, and hometowns of the victims. Separate the profiles into groups: preschool, middle school, high school, adults, older adults, and folks with pre-existing conditions. You can create something that will force the doubters to reconsider their positions. This is your chance to show your civic responsibility in the most striking way possible. I and many others would be happy to help you make up for any income you might lose from advertisers. And that's signed by Mark Stark of Cedar Rapids. And our next letter from Daniel McGrail, also in Cedar Rapids: create renamed park in Cedar Rapids. The current fashion to tear down or rename streets, parks, monuments, etc., so as to satisfy a small minority of self-righteous political correctives is to be deplored. I suggest the city of Cedar Rapids set aside one park, perhaps named Renamed Park, that these folks can rename whatever and whenever they like. Perhaps we could place some statues in there that could be ceremoniously torn down by the mob once a week. And that's signed by Daniel McGrail. Todd Dorman's 24-hour column, No Balance, with Lives in the Balance. Governor Kim Reynolds often talks of balance as she describes her approach to the COVID-19 pandemic. Protect lives and livelihoods, so reasonable. But for a dose of reality, read through the lawsuit filed in June and amended twice just last month against Tyson Foods by the families of three employees who caught the coronavirus at the company's Waterloo pork plant. Sedica Buljic, Ruberiano Lino Garcia, and Jose Ayala died of COVID-19. There's no balance. All there is are pages and pages and pages of unconscionable and callous conduct on the part of plant management. All the while, top executives lobbied for liability protections. Reynolds and her administration stood by and mimicked the company's line that everything was fine as hundreds of workers got sick. According to the lawsuit in U.S. District Court, Tyson, which has operations in China, including in the province where the virus was first detected, understood the threat as early as January, and yet by March, when cases started to crop up in Iowa, the company failed to proactively provide protective equipment or put distancing practices in place. Instead, according to the lawsuit, Waterloo plant managers deceived their employees. An amendment to the suit filed last week charges that managers told interpreters behind closed doors in early April to tell immigrant employees that everything is fine and there is no outbreak. Workers were to be told Black Hawk County public health officials had cleared the plant. In reality, local public health officials were urging the company to shut down the plant, where on April 10 they found workers still shoulder to shoulder with many not wearing face coverings. On April 11, an April 11 complaint about the plant came to Iowa OSHA. The case was closed on April 28 with no on-site inspection. Reynolds later said OSHA's action was appropriate. On April 20, Reynolds told reporters she opposed a shutdown. These also are essential businesses and an essential workforce, and without them, people's lives and our food supply will be impacted. So we must do our part to keep them open in a safe and responsible way, Reynolds said. Safe and responsible, apparently, including a betting pool for plant managers wagering on how many workers would contract the virus. In a conference call on April 20 with Reynolds, according to the lawsuit, top Tyson executives downplayed the outbreak and exaggerated safety measures. Reynolds bought it. I've been on the phone with the CEO and the management team for all Tyson plants to talk about what they're doing proactively to make sure that they're protecting their workforce, Reynolds told reporters that day. 2 days later, the stricken plant shut down. I'm sure Tyson has well-paid attorneys working on its rigorous defense. But if even a fraction of this stuff is true, it's a violation of not only workers' legal rights, but also their human rights. Companies act irresponsibly when they know no one will hold them accountable. Tyson knew Reynolds, a reliable ally of big agricultural interests, with campaign donations to prove it, would raise no objection to exploiting workers. With lives in the balance, Reynolds picked pork and profits over people. And again, that's Todd Dorman's No Balance with Lives in the Balance. And the political cartoon for today is a wife sitting at her desk with pen and paper ready, and her husband is sitting in the easy chair next to the Christmas tree lit up, and she says, "I got nothing." And his reply, "Maybe you should skip the brag letter for 2020. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Thursday, December 3, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. In the short notices, from Blairstown, Everett Kinsel, age 97, died Monday, November 30th. Phillips Funeral Home, Blairstown, is in charge. In Cedar Rapids, Vivian L. Johnson, age 88, died Tuesday, December 1, Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home, Cedar Rapids. In Decorah, Gladys W. Wepler, age 97, died Sunday, November 29. Fjellstuhl Funeral Home, Decorah, is assisting. In Fairfield, Laverne Michael Redlinger, age 83, of Fairfield, formerly of Harper, died Monday, November 30. Powell Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Kyoto, is assisting. In Maquoketa, Darlene H. Kuhn, age 84, died Tuesday, December 1, Carson Celebration of Life Center, Maquoketa. Also in Maquoketa, Ellen Cook, age 74, died Tuesday, December 1, the Carson Celebration of Life Center, Maquoketa. From Marion, Beverly J. Kanuck, age 93, died Wednesday, December 2, Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Marion, is assisting. From McGregor, David Remke, age 63, formerly of Decorah, died Monday, November 30. Thornburg Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service, McGregor, is assisting. And also in McGregor, Leo Joseph Schaefers, age 93, died Tuesday, December 1. Again, the Thornburg Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service is in charge. And in Randalia, Jamie Lee Solheim, age 50, died Monday, November 30. Schutte Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Claremont, is assisting. Moving to the regular notices, from Cedar Rapids, Mary Louise Ute, age 90, passed away November 28th at Edencrest at Sienna Hills in Ankeny, Iowa. A visitation will be held from 1 until the time of service Friday, December 4, at Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories, with certified celebrant Dr. James Coyle officiating. A live stream of the service can be viewed at client.tribucast.com starting at 2 p.m. Friday, December 4. Interment will be offered at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Again, that notice is for Mary Louise Ute. From Cedar Rapids, Bernie Lewis Conger passed away November 29 at the age of 78. Celebration of Bernie's vibrant life will be held at a later date when it is safe to do so. There will also be a private ceremony next year to return him to the sacred land of the Menominee Nation. That is an announcement for Bernie Conger. From Cedar Rapids, Larry Kubelek, age 76, passed away December 1 at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Service will be at 11 a.m. Saturday, December 5, at Rabick Newhouse Funeral Service with Deacon Joe Bohunek officiating. Burial will take place at National Cemetery, Vining, Iowa, with military honors. The service will be live-streamed through the funeral home webpage. The Newhouse Funeral Home is caring for the family of Larry Kubelek. From Cedar Rapids, Roger Norton, beloved fellow, husband, father, grandfather, uncle, and friend, along with being a humble person, passed away Wednesday, November 25, after a short illness. The Getch Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. Due to current health pandemic, a mass of Christian burial with a celebration following will be held in the spring of 2021. From Fairfax, John L., known as Jack Livingston, age 77, of Fairfax, passed away Monday, November 23, at his home following a 10-year battle with cancer. A private funeral mass will be held at the St. John's Catholic Church, 8100 Roncalli Drive in Cedar Rapids. Interment will follow at St. Patrick's Cemetery in rural Fairfax. A private visitation will be held on Sunday, December 6th at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Again, that notice is for Jack Livingston. From Decorah, Melvin Steele, age 93, passed away Wednesday, November 25, at Hillcrest Living in Sumner, Iowa. A graveside service will be held Sunday, November 29, at Glenwood East Cemetery, rural Decorah, with the Reverend Stacy Naline Carlson presiding. Again, that notice is for Melvin Steele. In Pleasant Plain, David Edward Jones, age 86, of rural Pleasant Plain, died peacefully at home Tuesday, December 1. A private graveside service for family will take place at Pleasant Plain Friends Cemetery. A service to celebrate life will be held at a later date. That notice, again, is for David Jones, and the Gould Funeral Home of Brighton is in charge of arrangements. From Marion, Chuang Juan Nguyen, age 79, passed away in his sleep surrounded by family Wednesday, December 2, at his home. Traditional Buddhist services will be held from 10 to 4, Saturday, December 5, at the Scottish Rite Temple, located at 616 A Avenue Northeast in Cedar Rapids, with cremation to follow the services. The Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. From Coralville, Shirley Ann Dornboss, age 85, passed away December 2 due to complications of COVID-19. She put up a courageous fight for several weeks in the ICU before going into palliative care at UIHC, where she passed away. Visitation will be held from 2 to 4 Friday, December 4 at St. Mary's Catholic Church. Again, that notice is for Shirley Dornboss. In Monticello, Gerald J. Muller, age 89, passed away Friday, November 27, at the Monticello Nursing and Rehab with his family by his side. A private family mass of Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, December 3 at Sacred Heart Catholic Church. The Reverend Paul Baldwin will officiate. A visitation will be held from 9:30 to 10:30 Thursday, December 3 at Kramer Funeral Home in Monticello. The Kramer Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements for Gerald Muller. In Vinton, Matthew, known as Matt John Selkin, age 51, died Tuesday, December 1, at his home in rural Vinton following an extended illness. Graveside services will be at 2 p.m. Monday, December 7, at Bear Creek Cemetery in Vinton, with the pastor Matt Hance officiating. The Van Steenhuis Russell Funeral Home of Vinton is assisting the family of Matthew Selkin. In Williamsburg, Patricia, known as Pat Michelle Malloy, died peacefully on November 30 at Highland Ridge Care Center in Williamsburg. She was 58 years old. A private mass of Christian burial will be held at St. Mary's Catholic Church, Williamsburg, with Father David Wilkening officiating. The public is welcome to attend the graveside service at 11:45 a.m. Saturday, December 5, at St. Michael's Cemetery in Holbrook. The Closter Funeral Home is assisting the family of Pat Malloy. And from Marengo, Ambrose J. Kahlberg, age 98, passed away Saturday, November 28, at Rosehaven Nursing Home, Marengo. A private memorial service will be held at Closter Funeral Home, Marengo, with Father Corey Close officiating. The Closter Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements for Ambrose Kahlberg. And lastly, from Cedar Rapids, Timothy David Kehoe, age 45, passed away at the Oldorf Hospice House in Hiawatha, Tuesday, December 1. There will be no services at this time. Tim is finally free from the demons that have plagued his short life. His liver and kidneys finally gave up their fight with the disease of alcoholism, which was Tim's vice. The Iowa Cremation Service is in charge of arrangements for Timothy Kehoe. Really no local sports to report for today. In the high school area, there is prep wrestling this evening. Cascade Bellevue will be at Regina at 5:30. Moving back to some community and Iowa Today stories, Iowa City and Cedar Rapids get top scores in Human Rights Index. The Human Rights Campaign has once again given Iowa City and Cedar Rapids perfect scores in its 2020 Municipal Equality Index. This marks the seventh straight year Iowa City has aced the index, which evaluates a city's non-discrimination laws, unemployment practices, municipal services, law enforcement and leadership on LGBTQ equality. The city actually scored 112 out of 100 with bonus points in some categories. It's Cedar Rapids' fifth consecutive year with a perfect score, this year scoring 102 out of 100 with bonus points. I'm proud to see that Iowa City has once again received a perfect score in the Municipal Quality Index, Iowa City Mayor Bruce Teague said in a statement. Although I know that Iowa City is a great place to call home, this high ranking provides clear evidence of the support and value that our community shows for our LGBTQ community. Dubuque also scored 100 for the second year in a row, with a score of 95 plus 5 bonus points. Other cities in Iowa ranked by the organization were West Des Moines with 99, Des Moines with 88, Ames with 87, Davenport with 84, Waterloo with 59, and Sioux City with 57. The index rated 506 cities across the United States based on 44 criteria. The full report and scorecards for cities nationwide can be found on the internet at hrc.org/MEI. And from Cedar Rapids, this story by Trish Mahaffey, a man charged after a high-speed chase. 37-year-old Lisbon man faces a number of charges after a high-speed chase that started in Central City and ended in Jones County. Hunter D. Campbell, during an initial appearance in Linn County District Court on Wednesday, was charged with attempt to elude, operating a motor vehicle under the influence of alcohol, third offense, possession of a controlled substance, marijuana, unlawful possession of a prescription drug, driving while licensed under suspension, and possession of drug paraphernalia, according to a criminal complaint. Campbell fled from deputies who attempted to stop his vehicle about 6:30 p.m. Tuesday for going 65 in a 20-mile-per-hour zone at 4th Street North and Commercial Street in Central City, according to the complaint. During the chase, Campbell blew through several stop signs as deputies pursued him with car lights and sirens on. The pursuit continued north on Highway 13 from Central City as Campbell reached speeds of 90 miles an hour in a 55 zone. He turned east on County Road D-62, reaching speeds of 85 and continuing into Jones County. A Monticello police officer eventually used stop sticks to disable the vehicle at Stonebridge Road, deflating the vehicle's two front tires, after which Campbell pulled over, according to the Linn County Sheriff's Office. Officers noted several signs of insobriety and saw several empty shot-sized alcohol bottles in plain view in the vehicle, the complaint said. Campbell was released from prison in May and on parole for convictions last year of second-degree fraudulent practices, making false unemployment claims, and drunken driving, according to the Iowa Department of Corrections. He was sentenced to 5 years in prison and was released after nearly a year. He also has previous convictions for drunken driving, stalking, and interference with official acts. The Linn County Sheriff's Office was assisted by the Monticello Police Department, the Jones County and Delaware County Sheriff's Offices, and the Iowa State Patrol. Moving to the living section of the paper today, this story by Allison Gowans for the Gazette, A Taste of Haiti. Anouce Michaud grew up cooking, learning from her aunt and mother, both in her original home in Haiti and then in Florida, where she moved just before turning 10. My mom would be cooking in a big pot, and she'd give me a small pot to cook alongside her, she said. I grew up in a big family, so I can never cook anything small, so I might as well cook for everyone. Now that's what she's doing, sharing the Haitian dishes she loves with Cedar Rapids. Michaud and her husband, Roni, opened the Carey Grill Creole Cuisine inside Lindale Mall in August, just 3 days before the derecho hit. I've been cooking and baking all my life for as long as I can remember, Anouce Michaud said. The couple previously owned La Vie Bakery on the southwest side, which they closed in March after the pandemic sent business plummeting. They hoped the new location in Lindale Mall would garner more foot traffic, and with the move, they also decided to switch from being primarily a bakery. We decided to lean into the savory food side of things, Michiel had said. Their menu includes Haitian dishes like oxtail stew, goat stew, fried pork, red snapper, and fried plantains. They also serve three kinds of rice, including mushroom rice, a Haitian specialty made by cooking the rice in water from dried mushrooms, which turns the rice black. It has so many flavors it dances in your mouth, Michiel said. Michiel said they source many of their ingredients through Chicago and Florida because they are having trouble finding them in eastern Iowa. Those include Haitian spices and the mushrooms for their rice. They also bring in fresh passion fruit to make their own juice, which they sell along with Caribbean soft drinks. They focus on Haitian foods, but also have other dishes as well. Roni Michiel's specialty is Jamaican meat pies. It's all about the flavor and making sure the dough is flaky, he said. The ladies in the kitchen make the dough, and I focus on the meat. Delivery is available through DoorDash, Uber Eats, Grubhub, and they just started a partnership with Chomp. The couple said they also will do delivery themselves, but prefer customers to use one of the third-party delivery services. They also do catering. Although they have some food on display in a buffet-style presentation, they prepare dishes to order. Michiel said, with Creole in the name, people often mistake them for a Louisianian restaurant. She said they also have a misconception that the food will be spicy. She said it isn't, although they offer a Haitian condiment, picles, for those who want some heat. Picles is made with pickled cabbage, carrots, bell peppers, and Scotch bonnet pepper. We add pepper to our food, but it's not spicy hot. It's spicy with flavor, she said. The couple moved to Iowa about 3 years ago for a job opportunity and now live in Marion. Anous Michiel was working in HR but gave up that job in October. She had a baby just before the pandemic arrived in Iowa, and caring for the baby, working full-time, and running the restaurant were too much, she said. Now she's able to focus on her family and her business. Serving food is what makes her happy, she said. I feel it takes me to a very happy place, she said. It's a part of me. In times of stress, I'm cooking. And if you go, again, the name is the Carrie Grill Creole Cuisine, located in the Lindale Mall. Hours are 11 to 8 p.m. Monday to Saturday, noon to 6 on Sunday. Hours may change dependent on seasonal mall hours. And in another food-related story, Zoe's Pizza reopens. Table closes temporarily. This by Allison Gowans. A long-standing Marion restaurant that was badly damaged in the derecho is standing again. Zoe's Pizzeria, 690 10th Street, reopened November 24 after completing storm repairs. Owner Denny Novak posted his thanks on Facebook, naming the contractors, staff, friends, family, customers, and others who helped the business come back after the August 10 hurricane force storm. What did you learn, Dorothy? There's no place like home. Marion is Zoe's home, and it's people like these that make a place truly a home. Thank you, he wrote. And Table, a North Liberty restaurant that opened earlier this year, is closing, at least for now. A Facebook post for the restaurant announced the decision. Sad doesn't even begin to describe how we feel at this moment, but as of today, Table is temporarily closing. We just weren't able to overcome the obstacles that COVID-19 has put in front of us, despite our best efforts. We're so thankful for our amazing staff and our loyal guests. Without you, we never would have gotten this far. But there's light at the end of the tunnel. This isn't goodbye. It's see you soon. We'll be back before you know it. And in the meantime, we'll be hard at work, getting ready to make Table's second chapter much better than the first. Stay tuned for our future plans. Owned by Ryan and Colleen Bell, Jesse and Becca Bender, Tim and Trisha Carty, Mitch Crandall, Amy and Darren Jensen, Paul Park, and Bobby and Kayla Thompson, Table opened at 575 Cameron Way in North Liberty this summer. The restaurant previously closed for a few days after a staff member tested positive for COVID-19 and reopened November 19 for carryout and delivery only. At the time, they wrote, "As much as we'd love to have you join us in person, we believe that the responsible thing to do is to bring our table to yours. The day will come when we gather again, and it will be amazing. Friends, we need you now. As you know, this pandemic has hit small business hard. We're certainly one of them." In a Business 380, this story by John Steppe for the Gazette, Iowa City-based Rantizo raises $7.5 million. Ag tech company seeks to accelerate drone spraying expansion. An Iowa City-based agricultural technology company raised $7.5 million in investments to accelerate company expansion with drone spraying technology through its latest round of fundraising, the company announced on Wednesday. Since starting in 2018, the company said it has raised $9 million. This year, Rantizo received requests from growers and individuals all over the country looking for drone application services, said Michael Ott, CEO of Rantizo. "We want to make sure we have Rantizo application services providers in place to keep up with demand. Securing this funding is a crucial piece of that strategy." Rantizzo is the only company authorized by the Federal Aviation Administration for drone spraying in Iowa after obtaining initial approval in July of 2019. Since then, Rantizzo has received approval for drone spraying nationwide. By using autonomous drones instead of traditional crop spraying methods, Rantizzo's use of drones avoids common issues associated with traditional spraying, such as soil compaction, chemical overuse, and drift, according to its news release. And in a final story, Christmas tree prices jump during pandemic. This is a Bloomberg News story reprint. Cola Vita Christmas Tree Farm never before had someone show up in early November wanting to buy a tree for the holidays, until this year. "I said, thanks for the compliment, but that's not going to last until Christmas," said Bob Cola Vita, who has owned the business outside Philadelphia for 24 years. The customer ended up buying a 6-foot Fraser fir anyway. She said, "I just want something happy in the house. Christmas trees, along with wreaths, lights, and other decor are in high demand this year, as many Americans embrace holiday festivity in face of the rising coronavirus cases and bleak predictions for winter. Two consumer trends are buoying demand. U.S. households are sitting on about $1.2 trillion more in savings than usual, and when they're spending, they're specifically targeting items to spruce up their home. The majority of consumers say they're more interested in holiday decorations and seasonal items than usual this year because of the pandemic, according to a survey by the National Retail Federation. For the tree industry, from the independent growers to the big stores that sell them, there's a lot on the line. Americans bought 26.2 million live trees last year to the tune of $2 billion, according to the National Christmas Tree Association. While the figure was down slightly from 2018, amid growing demand for artificial trees, last year was the first year in a long time that growers made a reasonable profit. Americans also are more likely to splurge on their purchase this year, the group said. The median price for trees sold in 2020 is expected to be $81, up 7% from last year and 23% from 2018. Big chains are taking notice, with Lowe's offering free tree delivery this year for the first time to snag market share. Lowe's and rival Home Depot are trying to sell more holiday decorations and gifts this season to further capitalize on an already strong year after the so-called essential retailers remained open throughout the pandemic. That does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It's Thursday, December 3. I've been your reader, Kathleen Jesperson. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening, and have a great day. We'll be right back.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Shortly after modern humans arrived in Europe, the Neanderthals disappeared, and scientists think we had something to do with it. Neanderthals, or their direct ancestors, migrated out of Africa and into the Middle East and Europe around 250,000 years ago. Soon, they were well adapted to the environment. Large eyes helped them see in the longer nights and darker winters. Stout bodies helped them retain heat and handle large prey, and provided space for the large liver and kidneys needed for a diet heavy in protein. Their brains were as big as ours, but spent processing power on their greater visual and motor abilities. This may not have allowed them to develop higher communication or conceptual thinking to match ours, which may have been their downfall. Modern humans arrived on the scene 45,000 years ago, less physically adapted, but more mentally adaptable. We had cooperative hunting methods superior to the Neanderthals, allowing us to outcompete them for food, and perhaps reducing the large herbivore populations that they depended on. We also had superior tools and weapons. When there were conflicts between the groups, as there have been among tribes throughout history, our superior technology probably allowed us to prevail. But we weren't only fighting. There must have been considerable interbreeding, since we can find 1-3% of the Neanderthal genome in modern man. Which means the Neanderthals never completely disappeared. A little bit of them is alive in us today. I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.